Groove Podcasts. All right. Thank you, Science and Responsibility, for the opportunity, for the invitation. Thank you, the University of Heidelberg. Also, thank you, Dr. Fassmann. Thank you, Dr. Exenberger. Thank you, Barbara. I think it's important for us to talk more openly about these issues. These are issues which are often not well understood. There are misperceptions, and the debate tends to be polarized. So my idea, my attempt, will be to talk responsibly, hopefully responsibly, about these issues, drawing from the tools of social science. Now, the title, as you can see, is Multiculturalism and Integration, Changes and Challenges, Challenges and Changes. When you think about multiculturalism, you probably think about the coexistence of different cultures, different competing sets of values, the celebration of diversity in many ways, the existence of cultural pluralism. That's generally how most people, I would say, would readily identify multiculturalism. But there is another dimension, and this dimension has a more social or policy-making component to it. That means multiculturalism as a social prescription, as a guideline, as a principle that would help policymakers manage diversity, manage social integration. And that's largely what I'll talk about when I address the story in the UK. Because as you probably know, there are different ways, there are different methods to integrate minority groups. And one way would be this multicultural way, following it as a social policy, not simply as these idealistic abstraction, something that has more of an institutional say. There are other ways as well, and France shows us the so-called assimilationist way, and I'll get to that once I talk about the UK. Now, we need a definition of integration to start off with. I mean, I know that we can fill entire libraries with books about this definition, about the theory of integration, but my definition, the one I would like to use for the purpose of this talk, is the following. Integration refers to arrangements that enable migrants and their children or grandchildren, so second generation and third generation, to actively participate in a host society through equality of opportunity and the absence of discrimination on the basis of ethnicity, national origin, religion, and so forth. So that's the definition I'm using. And that doesn't come from me, that comes from social scientist Bimal Ghosh. But I find it appropriate because it's broad enough that it gives us something to play with for the moment. You'll say, well, there are other aspects of integration, sure. You can talk about economic integration, and we'll address these issues. You can talk about linguistic, structural, and so many other ways. But let's just use this one for the moment. With this in mind, when I look back, when I think about the post-World War II developments in the UK, I see waves of migration, mostly coming from former British colonies. You had a big wave of Caribbean, or what is known as the West Indies, coming in 1948. In the 50s, India became independent in 1947, so in the 50s you had mass waves of migration coming from Asia. In the 70s, you had a big wave of the so-called African Asians from countries such as Uganda, Malawi, Tanzania. There were some dictators, the likes of Idi Amin, who expelled many Asians. And most of these Asians had Indian background. They were mostly business owners. And they left these countries, and many of them ended up going to the UK. So when we are talking about minority groups in the UK, and talking about integration, I'm really talking about this the non-white groups, such as those coming from former colonies. Now, already in the 1950s, if you think about what happened in Notting Hill in 1958, there were already racial tensions involving the white population and the Caribbeans. So England at this time already in the late 50s, early 60s, was faced with a very difficult question. And the question is, what model should we follow here? How should we integrate? What approach should we follow? And they decided consciously to go for a multicultural approach in order to preserve the cultural, in order to give minority groups the opportunity to practice their culture, I mean, in so many different aspects of life, but also as a way to promote social cohesion. So the idea was not to make an immigrant blend completely into English society. The idea was simply to regulate the interaction between members of minority groups and members of the larger British society. However, there was the necessity to institute legal frameworks, institutional arrangements, legal provisions. So they did that through what are known as the Race Relations Acts. And there was one in established in 1968, there was another in 1976, and there were other ones later on. And what did these acts do? These acts reinforced, they specified specific guidelines to promote racial equality and to foster equality of opportunity. In doing so, this laws also fully recognized the existence of minority groups. That's not the case in France. As I'll talk about, hopefully I will have time to do that, you'll see that France does not acknowledge minority groups, which makes our lives, the lives of social scientists, very difficult because we cannot get the statistics we need. We cannot measure the problem if there is some sort of tension involving immigrants. It's tough. But in England, that's not the case. So before this laws, before these acts, let's say in the 50s, discrimination on the basis of race for housing opportunities was legal. So that stopped in 1968. And in 1976, they extended these provisions to include other parts of other spheres of British life, so not only housing, but employment, education, and so on. And then you might think, oh, that's wonderful. So does that mean that racism abolished? Did these laws work? Well, of course, not fully. And that's why I want to tell you a little story. And this is an important story. It's the story of a boy called Stephen Lawrence. Now, this story will take you back to April 22nd, 1993, 10:30 p.m. Stephen Lawrence was waiting for the bus with a friend, and Stephen Lawrence was a black British boy. His parents came from Jamaica. And within a few seconds, he was approached by a number of people. He was stabbed multiple times. Those involved in this case ran away. Stephen managed to, he tried to escape, of course. He managed to run maybe 200 meters or so. But ultimately, he collapsed and he bled and he died. He bled to death. There were, of course, investigations trying to assess who committed this crime. And the Metropolitan Police Force in London ended up arresting five suspects, but none of them were convicted. And in 1999, Sir William McPherson thought, no, there is something wrong. I think this case should be revisited. We should look more closely to see how the case of Stephen Lawrence was handled. And they found out that there were a number of mistakes. There were a number of clues which the police missed completely or ignored. There were racist remarks made in private. The police officers failed to provide Stephen Lawrence with first aid when they reached the scene of the crime. And this report, which symbolizes perhaps the single most important piece of legislation in the history of, in the modern history of criminal justice in England related to integration, said that the Metropolitan Police in England was institutionally racist. This was a watershed event in the history of England as far as integration, because the recommendations of the McPherson report, also known as the Stephen Lawrence report, forced other services to more actively promote racial equality, to promote equality of opportunities. Other bodies, such as local authorities, such as the National Health Service, such as the civil service. So this was a very important moment in the history of the country in this sense. And you may wonder, okay, what is institutional racism? I'm defining it as the failure, the collective failure of an organization to adequately provide professional service to people on the basis of race, ethnicity, national origin, and the like. So by saying this, I just want to highlight that England has legal frameworks to address racial inequality, to promote anti-discrimination laws, to promote equality of opportunity, but the picture is far, far from perfect. And this brings me to the issue of economic integration. You'll see that, let me just show you some, just to give you a sense of the population I'm talking about. So this should give you a better idea of the different groups in England. And although they are recognized, there's a big disparity between how certain minority groups are doing in comparison to others. Within the Asian community, the Indians and the African Indians are doing much better off economically if you look at different indicators such as income, but also where they are as far as the economic sector, if they're working for the service sector, manufacturing, non-manual labor, manual labor. You'll see that in many ways, some groups are doing even better than the average white British, if we take that as the average. Whereas other minority groups, such as the Bangladeshis and the Pakistanis, are not doing as well. And this is not, I'm not trying to pick on them. You'll say, hey, your parents are Indian, so you're biased. No, this is not something about, this is not about nationalism. But the facts are clear. This graph here shows how they're doing as far as education, and you see that a lot of the Pakistani, Jamaicans, and Bangladeshi kids are not doing as well as the average. And whereas some groups, such as the Sri Lankans, the Indians, the Iranians, the Chinese, do very well. So it's not a monolithic picture. You should not think that the failure or the challenges of integration in England are equal, or they hurt different communities equally. No, they don't. I mean, it's more complex than that. As far as geographical integration, or if you think about where they are concentrated, you will see that in the name of multiculturalism, England managed to create what are monocultural neighborhoods. So instead of multiculturalism, you're really talking about what Amartya Sen in his book, Identity and Violence, says, monocultural pluralism. You have different communities, but the level of interaction between these communities is not particularly high. So that's another reason why this model, the multicultural model, has come under so much criticism lately. This provides you with another interesting set of data to show the percentage of people who are benefiting from social housing, and then again, you get a better sense of how these people are doing, how different ethnic groups are doing. This is interesting as well for us to see levels of employment, unemployment, inactivity, and again, I think it's striking to see the high level of inactivity affecting the Bangladeshi and the Pakistani community. There are reasons for this. You may wonder, okay, but why is that? I mean, culturally, Indians, Bangladeshis, Pakistanis, they have a lot in common. Yes, they do. However, if you look at the first wave of immigrants that came to England in the late 50s, late 60s, you'll notice that many of those who came from Bangladesh, back then it was not Bangladesh, it was you had East Pakistan, West Pakistan, they came from largely non-urban centers. They came from village settings, levels of education were not particularly high, economic conditions, the amount of money they brought with them was also not much. So all of these factors make it harder for people to integrate when they move into an urban setting. So I think there is something to be said about the initial conditions, the socioeconomic factors that accompany these people. Now, just to give you an idea here of how, this is a picture I took in Bradford. Now, if any of you doubt what I'm saying about this notion of monocultural pluralism, just take a tour around cities such as Bradford or Blackburn or Birmingham, parts of Birmingham at least, and you'll see how instead of social integration, you're really looking at social isolation, fragmentation, lack of cohesion. Things have not worked as well as they should have, or as well as expected, which in some ways has led to greater concerns, greater challenges. Think about the recent terrorist attacks, what England calls 7/7, the bombings. So 7/7 also proved to be an important date as far as making people in England reconsider the applicability of this model. So the multiculturalism is under revision, and nowadays there is more talk about social integration than multiculturalism. There is a sense that multiculturalism has either gone too far, some sort of multiculturalism gone wild approach, or that it hasn't delivered its promises. And that's why you have initiatives such as citizenship exams. You have something called Life in the UK exam that tries to get a sense of whether people, immigrants, know something about the history of England, about civics, and so on. At the same time, while reconsidering this model, a lot of people looked at France and they thought, what if we learn some things from the French model? So let me talk briefly about that. I mean, the French model, instead of recognizing, as I said, minority groups, it essentially sees all French citizens as equal before the law. It doesn't recognize minorities. You don't really have the right to be different. For the sake of republican principles, they are certainly quite proud of these. I mean, it plays an important role in French history. If you think about what happened during the French Revolution, the French integration model, which could be called the republican model, is based on the ideals of equality, fraternity, neutrality, secularism, what the French call laïcité. So in theory, I don't have a problem with that, but the problem with it is that there is a big gap between the theory of social cohesion and the practice of what I would call social exclusion. So, and that proved to be, I think the world found out about that during the riots in 2005, which affected many of these suburban neighborhoods. When an American thinks about a suburb, an American thinks about these smart residential areas, beautiful houses with a basketball ring and the perfect garden. That's not the case. That's not how French suburbs, especially if you go around Paris, look like. And that's where most of the North African migrants were housed once they came in the 50s and the 60s. And they essentially stayed there. And afterwards, they were joined by their family members. And these are big housing projects. They're not well equipped. The infrastructure is bad. The schools in many of these banlieues are not necessarily good. And it's very hard for people to come out of these banlieues, because there is also a great deal of discrimination, which cannot be measured, because, as I said, France does not acknowledge minorities. But anecdotally, there is a clear sense that if your name is Mohammed, or if your name is Ahmed instead of Jean-Pierre, and if you come from one of these areas, your chances of getting a job, or your chances of your CV, your resume, being looked at are much lower than a white French person. So this is something which is a key challenge in the French model, the fact that so many people are still not being treated equally, although you have, in theory, wonderful ideals. And both the left and the right, the socialists and the conservatives, didn't quite have a good answer, a good response, a good set of ideas to tackle this issue. Sciences Po, as you probably know, one of the elite universities, one of the most prestigious universities in Paris, has recently introduced what the French call positive discrimination policies. And these policies essentially target a number of high schools that are located in the banlieue, and the principals of these schools, they have a selection process. They give an assignment to students. They say you have to collect articles from a newspaper, and then you have to summarize and write an analysis. And they have other activities like this, so they can see who is really motivated. And once the principal selects a number of students, of pupils, then representatives of Sciences Po conduct a one-day interview, and ultimately some of these people are able to join this prestigious university. A lot of people in France don't like these things. They feel as if it goes against the principles that define the country. However, the truth of the matter is that rich people have an upper hand. I mean, in order to attend many of these universities, you have to take placement exams, and if you have the means to afford private coaching and private preparation, you have better chances. And the statistics show this. In 1987, 77% of the students who attended Sciences Po came from privileged backgrounds. And in 1997, the percentage became even higher. It was something close to 83%. So there is evidence to prove this. As I said, the government is not particularly hasn't come up with a good strategy, but Sarkozy is someone who at least recognizes the failures of the French model. And Sarkozy, although very very controversial in with some of his statements and with also some of his tactics when he was interior minister, he used words such as scum and referring to people living in the suburbs and implying that they should be hosed off with a high-pressured hose pipe. And he also implemented very heavy-handed security tactics, which a lot of people in these suburbs don't like. I mean, it created this climate of confrontation between the police and a lot of young people there who suffer from high levels of unemployment. But in fairness to Sarkozy, I think he has been probably one of the only politicians in France to have actually visited these suburbs, to have actually talked to some of the families. And as I said, who seems to recognize the shortcomings of the models. But we have yet to see what will happen, how will France address the issue of integration. So this is simply to illustrate that we have different models, the UK favoring a more multicultural model, the French model more based on this notion of oneness, of assimilation, trying to blend its foreign population into something homogeneous in order to create some sort of cohesion. Now, the fundamental question we have to ask ourselves when we think about France, in some ways when we think about England as well, is should the unity of a nation be achieved at the cost of its cultural diversity? I think that's really the fundamental question that the French government and French society as a whole is trying to answer. And perhaps this would be an interesting question for us to discuss, how to deal with this fact. I mean, most societies nowadays accept the value or recognize the value of diversity for the betterment of everyone who live in this society. But the French, in many ways, are still resistant to it. Now, this brings me to Germany, and I'll just take maybe 2-3 minutes. I think most of you are familiar with the German story, also involving guest workers. Such was the case in Austria. So that's why I think some of you might know something about that story. But the interesting thing in Germany is that although there were so many immigrants and foreign-born people living amongst their midst, Germany, for a very long time, never saw itself as a country of immigration. And that's why you had citizenship laws based on this notion of jus sanguinis, that you can only be German if you have German blood. And you had second, third generation of sons and daughters of migrants who were born in the country, who could speak perfect German, who perhaps didn't know anything about the country of their parents, but who were still deprived of many benefits which German people were able to get. And German, even including those who came from other parts of Europe later on. After 1989, many ethnic Germans moved into Germany. This is also probably a familiar story. And the funny thing back then was that you had Germans, and I'm stressing this point, I think it would be a mistake to call these people non-Germans, and given the fact that maybe their parents were born in German and they were born in German as well. But they were certainly better integrated than many of these ethnic Germans that came from other parts of Europe. But they were able to get many of the benefits instead of those who were living or who were born and raised in the country. But things have changed, and now Germany has a more flexible citizenship law which allows naturalization. And I think the country is taking some steps, and I'm cautiously optimistic about the way things are being done in Germany. There are some initiatives such as exams, similar to what you have in England. There are public campaigns, the Du bist Deutschland campaign, and they had these big posters with the pictures of children who one would say look stereotypically non-German, with slogans such as Ich bin ein Berliner or Typisch Deutsch. So these are small, you may say these are small, these are big, these are medium-sized initiatives to at least make people perhaps think about this issue in a different way, in a broader way, in a more nuanced, in a more differentiated way. So that is the story there. Let me just close with one remark. And you might wonder, what is the solution? If I knew it, I guess we wouldn't be talking here in the first place. But you may wonder, how do I feel? And I can tell you one thing. I think it's not fair to always blame the state and to think that the state will be able to fix everything and to promote a perfect sort of integration. I think immigrants do have a fair share of responsibilities. It's a two-way street. But of course, they have to live in an atmosphere in which their differences, in my view at least, appreciated. It's not only about tolerance. I think tolerance is the most basic thing you can expect from a society. I think we really have to move our discourse beyond this idea of tolerance in order to include words such as acceptance and true appreciation. So I think integration ultimately is not a hotel. You know, when you go to a hotel, you get your key, you go into your room, and you do whatever you want, and nobody probably knows what you're doing, and then you come out, you pay your bill, you leave. No, it's really not like that. I think we really have to think about this as what you call in German, a WG, a student WG. I used to live in one of these, so I know it very well. It's a place that allows people to engage in dialogues where they have to discuss, where they have to share common responsibilities. And in some ways, as a result, they create common values, they create a better understanding of each other. So I'll leave you with that, with this analogy, and let's see what questions we have. I thank you very much for your attention.